No, that's what I'm saying, that there can be a conflict. And if there's a conflict, it can be pathogenic.
You know, the known phrase, the power of positive thinking seems a little trite, but is this, could you say that last one is the reason for positive thinking? I mean, that's, you know, if in fact you're succeeding at something, that's a good reason for positive.
I would hesitate to say it's the reason, but you might say it's a rationale. I think that you have the same thing involved here. The initial formulation of intentional action did not have achievement as one of the parameters. It was left open as to whether a given behavior succeeded. Now, achievement is part of the is one of the parameters, and you have a special form of description to get at those cases where you have an effort but not a success. And the reason for this is that it sank in at some point that the paradigm of human behavior is necessarily successful behavior. If you didn't have successful behavior, you wouldn't even have the concept of unsuccessful behavior. Therefore, it would be appropriate to formulate behavior in terms of what it succeeded at. And that ties in with the notion that you have a reason to, with all of your behavior, look at it in terms of what you succeeded at. Well, as I say, you can see why you can have qualms about some maxims and others are just obvious. And the ones we have are almost a minimum set. It'd be hard to get along with less. You could certainly get along with more. And there has really not been a lot of pressure in terms of the particular problems that we've dealt with to generate more. I don't know, if you were dealing with certain problem areas, you might be strongly motivated to generate a few more. But so far, we haven't.
You mentioned at one time, a couple of weeks ago, I guess, that you would make systematic statements and then were, I think, something like comments on the system. You may know that kind of distinction.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying.
Yeah, what I'm doing now is making comments and saying that you could have other maxims. That's not part of the system. Yeah. The maxims themselves so far are.
I get the feeling somehow that the notion of reason is somehow hanging loose here.
No, it's part of the system in that it goes with deliberate action.
So it came the development of deliberate action.
Yeah.
And the perspectives. So the reasons tying it back to the perspectives.
Right. It's the perspectives that give you reasons, pro and con. And remember, we generated the perspectives in a formal way by saying if there's going to be choice, there has to be formally a principle of choice. Turns out we have four. As it turns out that in fact we have at least four.
I don't see this perspective as being principles for choice, but more classes of reasons.
I said formally principles of choice.
They don't give you any.
In fact, they are competence. There are things that you know how to do. There are things you have the ability to do. For example, compare them to having vision. If I can see, then if there's something to be seen, I can see it. If I have mastered this perspective, then if a behavior is pleasant or unpleasant, I can deal with it as such. If I can see, if the thing looks dangerous, I can react to it. Whereas if I couldn't see, I couldn't use looking dangerous as a reason for choosing one behavior over another. If I can distinguish right and wrong, then the fact that a behavior is wrong will give me a reason not to do it. But if I couldn't make that distinction, if I couldn't use it, I couldn't have that reason either.
It gives you a foundation.
Not a foundation, it's a competence. That's the closest analogy I can think of is vision.
But it doesn't give you a vision is for choosing between a whole bunch of reasons.
No, it gives you reasons because it enables you to choose among behaviors. Because you can see behaviors as right or wrong, or more right or more wrong. And seeing them that way automatically gives you reasons. In the same way that seeing something as dangerous gives you reason to avoid it. So it's a competence notion, basically, these perspectives. And that's why you'll hear me using phraseology like if you have mastered the use of the perspectives, or if you've mastered a particular perspective. By mastered, I mean if you've acquired that competence.
You didn't acquire it. Be a deficit. It should be impairing ability to carry out intentional action.
Yeah, look, the reason it's like vision is that if you can see, you can understand the question, what does it look like? If you can't see, you can't understand that question, much less answer it in various ways. Now, if you have, say, the ethical perspective, you can understand the question, would it be right to do that? And you can therefore accept or reject various answers. If you hadn't mastered that way of looking at behavior, you couldn't even understand the question. So the competence there precedes any kind of answers or decisions of that sort, just like vision precedes any kind of visual description. So it's foundational only in the sense that it's a necessary condition, but not foundational in the sense of a logic or a deduction or anything of that sort. Okay, any further questions on Maxim 4 and how it works? Let me comment by way of anticipating some of the substantive theoretical stuff, is that Maxim 4 covers the kind of facts that are quite important in either developmental theories or in the developmental portions of general theories of behavior. Because when in other formulations you encounter phrases like overdetermination of behavior or scheduling of behaviors or a postponement of gratification or integrating motivations, all of those are essential in the process of growing up, in the process of socialization. And all of those sorts of notions are what is dealt with Maxim 4 and what we did with it. So even though Maxim 4 is tricky, if you follow the kind of moves we made, you will find those moves in various theories and developmental formulations. Okay, now by pleasant contrast, look at Maxim 5. Maxim 5 says if a situation calls for a person to do something he can't do, he'll do something he can do. Now, that one is a reminder of the whole notion of powers that we develop in our ID concept. Remember I said that a person's powers set limits to his possible behaviors, because if there's a behavior that would require that he knows something he doesn't, he can't engage in it. There's a behavior that would require that he wants something he doesn't want, he can't engage in it. And if there's a behavior that would require that he have abilities that he doesn't have, he can't engage in it. So this maxim is simply a reminder of that kind of limitation. And you could clearly have three of them, one couched in terms of knowledge, one in terms of motivation, and one in terms of competence. Since we were able to define both knowledge and value in terms of ability, the reminder is couched in terms of competence, and you can fudge in the rest. Any questions about that, Max?
The special case of that, doing something you can do.
No behavior is a non-behavior. In cases where you would normally describe a person as doing nothing, there is something else that you could also describe him as doing. No, I said no behavior is a non-behavior. There's no such thing as non-behavior. See, if you're asleep, then I would say you're not behaving. But normally, we wouldn't say that when you're asleep, you're doing nothing. We'd say you're asleep. Where you'd normally say he's doing nothing is, for example, if CJ is sitting there and I ask him a question and he doesn't answer and he doesn't do anything that's recognizable, then you say he's doing nothing. But if I ask him a question and he just continues to sit and doesn't answer me, there is something else that he's doing, even though we don't know what, maybe. Now, the case where you're asleep, where you're literally not engaging in behavior, is dealt with under the ID description, but that's a particular state. So you don't have to describe being in that state as a case of engaging in behavior. And then if you say, well, but isn't that a case of doing anything? The answer is, yeah. Not doing anything means not engaging in any behavior. Isn't that what you mean when you say a person who's asleep is not doing anything? That he's not engaging in any behavior. So being in a state in which you're not engaging in any behavior is, you get at that with a state description, not with a behavior description.
Yeah, but if you ask a person, can you please jump off the bridge, and they freeze, they go into a state of paralysis or catatonia, you would say, well, you could say even that person just went into that state, just in that state, or you could say that person just became catatonic.
Yeah.
Which is behavior.
No. His becoming catatonic is not a behavior, it's an achievement, it's an event. And his being in that state explains why he's not doing any of the things that you might think. Catatonia is just another state like sleep, which can explain why you're not engaging in behavior. In general, the way that you account for periods of time during which the person is not engaging in actions is that he's in some kind of state. And it can be catatonic, or it can be asleep, or it can be unconscious, or drunk, or any one of a variety of them. But it's the same general kind of explanation, is that he is in this particular state. And that being in a particular state is a person description, not a behavior description. Okay, now, I said that maxims 1 through 5 deal with primarily the parameters of intentional action. We saw 1 and 2 were associated with K, 3 and 4 are associated with W, and 5 with K. Now, maxims 6, 7, and 8 are associated with person characteristics. You know, maxim 6 is a simple one. It says a person acquires facts by observation and thought. I think that's a fairly straightforward maxim. We certainly are familiar with those ways of acquiring facts.
Where does experience come
from? Not until the next one. So remember, if I make an observation, normally that's the kind of situation that you would describe by saying I was experiencing something. Now, it happens that I think the only place I use the word experience is in maxim 6. And that's because that word, like some number of others, has been used in such strange ways that it's lost practically all its communication value. So rather than use that word, like I use others that seem more apropos. Well, as I say, acquiring facts by either observation or thought is a familiar enough thing, so that I don't anticipate that that raises many questions. Does it? Okay, now the next one, so the person acquires concepts and skills by practice and experience. Incidentally, these maxims are in one of your appendices. So you don't have to write them down. You can use the appendix to check on my wording. And the wording is crucial.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
The relation between observation and thought, why thoughts in parentheses?
Thoughts in parentheses, mainly because I don't want to get into it. As the whole topic of thought is large, it's like language. Remember, I just gave you the verbal formula, so that we're not going to get into that because there's too much there. Well, same holds for thought. That clearly there are some things that you acquire by thought without any new observations, but I don't want to get into the whole business of what is thought and how does it work, etc. Not unless we have time at the end of the semester. Because this outline is a stripped down version that is geared specifically for dealing with personality theories and certain clinical applications. So it's not the whole system, but there's enough in it to get us what we want. And so you have to slough off certain things, and thought is one of them. I don't mean that we're going to approach this in a thoughtless way.
Gregory Bateson was talking about information as the difference that makes a difference. And equating information with pretty common facts. But information, he broke down into content and context. It seems as though you would acquire content by observation and context by observation or thought, but not content by thought.
If you tell me that A is greater than B and B is greater than C, I can figure out that A is greater than C, and I get that by thought. And that's content.
Yeah, but
it sure as hell is an observation. You never said that A is greater than C.
I was going to say it was context, not content. It's context and what your system, you're seeing the system. That allows you to
just
say,
look, if that's content, then anything of the same sort is content. And if you give me these two, I can generate this.
Because we generate that by the rule which says you can generate.
I know, I generate by a rule, but what I generate is by God content. That's a fact, just as these are facts. So I may appeal to something else, indeed I would have to beyond just these. But what I wind up with is something that is of the same sort, namely another fact. And that's why you have to include thought when it comes to how you acquire facts. But as I say, it's tricky enough to not warrant going any further than that. That was just for sake of formal completeness here.
In that case, you mean by observations.
Well, I'm tempted to say, if you don't know what observation is, it's not clear what anybody could tell you. But suppose I try this. Whether say, to observe something is either to see it, hear it, touch it, smell it, or feel it. Now that's not a formal definition, but it's a better explanation than the formal one. It says, to acquire something by observation is to not have to acquire some other piece of information first. See, the notion of observation is based on the fact that knowledge has to start somewhere because you don't have an infinite regress, and wherever it starts is what we will call observation. It happens that, in fact, where we start are seeing things, hearing them, touching them, etc. And that's why referring to those is more informative than just the formal definition. And indeed, we find out facts by watching people, by hearing them, by touching them, etc. Okay, what about Maxim 6? It's acquire concepts and skills by practice and experience. Or seven, rather. And the relevant experience is participation in some social practice that involves the distinction or requires the skill. Now, to explicate that, we have to come back to the fact that concepts are prior to facts. See, if I don't have the concept of a table, I can't by observation establish any facts about tables, for example, if there's one sitting there. If I don't have a given concept, I can't acquire any of the facts that would be stated in terms of that concept. So the acquisition of concepts will precede the acquisition of facts involving that concept. And whereas you acquire facts by observation, you acquire concepts in a different way, namely by living in a certain way, by participating in a form of behavior that requires that distinction. If you learn to participate in a form of behavior that requires that distinction, you will acquire that distinction. Because if you didn't, you couldn't be said to have participated in that form of behavior. So it's another tautology. Now, what this is intended to get at is first-hand learning versus second-hand. That's why the phrase, by experience. And this applies both to concepts and to skills. For example, you learn how to ride a bicycle by trying it and practicing. You don't learn by somebody telling you. You learn to distinguish red from blue by doing it, not because somebody has told you that they're different. So Maxim 7 gets at the acquisition of some fundamentals. And the way you do it is, as I say, by having the right kind of history, by living in a certain way. Notice this doesn't require that we say which ways. Simply that some histories will get you certain concepts and skills, others will not.
What room is left for coming up with a new concept?
Well, just that one.
But suppose I would come up with a concept which hadn't been thought of before or wasn't recognized before. I came up with it without engaging in any social practices. And that's
how would you be in a position to say that it was a concept rather than simply a meaningless word that you uttered?
I'd be able to use it.
That would be your social practice.
Yeah,
if there's a way of using it, if there's a way of using it, then you can say, this way of behaving requires this distinction. But if there is no way of using it and you simply have a word, who's to know what distinction it is? Who's in a position to say that it is a distinction at all?
I'm saying that if I came up with that, I acquired it without engaging in any relevant social practice.
Let's begin next time by talking about ex post facto concepts, because that's what's going to be involved.
Say maybe a sentence or two about number 5. He would do something he can do. Does that include not doing anything? In other words,
no. Not doing something is going to be a case of doing something else.
Right, that's what I mean. Yeah. So if he can't do something, if the calls for him to do something he can't do, then
he'll do something he can do.
Yeah, but does that include, for example, if he's sitting there and calls for him to get up and can't, he'll continue to sit there, which would be nothing. It would be something, but everybody, you know, the usual jargon, you would say, well, he didn't do anything.
Right.
But he's still doing something.
Right.
Okay, that's all I have. That's what I
okay.
Also, that same maxim, I've enlisted in the KH parameters, it's a significant parameter, know-how parameter there. But also that it seems that it would be in terms of competence or an achievement description. That would be crucial also. But I'm just wondering how that fits into my own mind. I have really not a specific question.
I'm not sure I get the thrust of
right.
That.
Right. This is that given.
Let me explain again that this maxim is a redo on the explanation that says that in connection with knowledge, values, and abilities, which are key to these three, that if there is behavior that would require either knowledge you don't have or motivation you don't have or abilities or know-how that you don't have, then that is not behavior you can engage in. Now, this maxim is simply a reminder of that, that if there is behavior that the situation calls for, but is behavior that would require a cage that you don't have, then you're still not going to do it. Instead, you'll make use of the cage that you have and the abilities you have. And it's a reminder couched primarily in these terms, but as I said, since we defined these others in terms of ability, the reminder couched in terms in competence terms will do for the all three. And in a way, what it amounts to is you can't do what you can't do.
When you say motivation, that's not just the W parameter, that includes reasons as
right.
well. Okay, because
when you talk about a person's values, the terms in which you specify the values are usually categories for the kind of reasons that have priority with it. Now, I have a dim recollection at the end of the hour. You raised a question, and I said, let's begin next time talking about ex post facto phenomena. I think the question was in connection with number 7 of acquiring concepts and skills. And it said, suppose somebody invents a concept. Was that it? Okay, let me present you with this kind of example. I think we'll need both a notion of ex post facto and a paradigm case formulation. Consider the case where I tell you, hey, I've invented a new game. And then you say, well, what is it? I say, well, it hasn't got a name yet. And you say, well, tell me about it. You say, well, I can't describe it to you. About this point, you're scratching your head. You say, well, look, teach me how to play it. I say, well, it can't be taught either. I think about that point, you turn away and say, he hasn't really got a new game yet.
That's the game.
Yeah. if it were that, it could be taught. In contrast, suppose that when you ask me, I give it a name, and then when you ask me to describe it, I can describe it, and then when you ask me to teach it to you, I can teach it to you, and then we play. Now, under those conditions, you wouldn't have any doubt whatever that when I said I had a new game, I had a new game. In contrast, the first case, you'd have every doubt that I had a new game. And I'll consider that initial situation, which is the same in both cases, where all I do is say, hey, I've got a new game. Now, at that point, you can't distinguish which of those two cases it's going to turn out to be. At the point where I merely say, hey, I've got a new game, you can't tell whether it's the case where I can't name it, I can't tell it, and I can't teach it, or if it's the case where I can do all of these. Now, since in the one case you conclude that I don't have the new game, and in the other case you conclude that I do, at that point you can't say whether I do or not. Now, if it turns out to be the second kind, namely, where I can name it, describe it, and teach it, then you can say, after we've done all that, yes, he really had it back then. That's what I mean by ex post facto. Later on, it turns out that it already was there back then, but at that time, you're going to be hard put to say it's already there then.
However, if he acquired that concept without any practicing and experiencing the role.
Yeah, that's okay. That's not yet an answer to your question. Just introducing this concept. Now, where paradigm case formulation comes in is that the second case where I can name it, tell it, and teach it has to be the paradigm case. And the rule of thumb is just imagine that all of our cases of inventing new games were like the first case. Namely, that I can't name it, tell it, or teach it. The rule of thumb is, if all of our cases were that kind, and we would have a different concept of game, then that kind isn't a paradigm. I think it's quite clear that if all our cases of inventing new games were the kind where I couldn't name it, tell it, or teach it, our notion of inventing a new game would not be what it is now. That our paradigm for inventing a new game is that indeed you can name it, tell it, and teach it, and that's our paradigm. Now, once we have the paradigm, then it will make sense via what amounts to deletion operations. Via deletion operation, to talk about simply having this much, namely, you simply have the notion of a new game. And the notion of a new game will be your notion of a concept. Because that will be one instance of a concept. Now notice the paradigm does involve the social practice. To teach it to me, in fact, even describing it to me, is to engage in a social practice that involves using this distinction. Certainly teaching it to me with the criteria that we finally play it involves a social practice of using that concept. So paradigmatically then, the reference to the necessity for a social practice within which that concept has a place is there in the paradigm. And it's a derivative case too that involves just having it without having this. And the only time you can do that is either as a bare claim without ever putting it to this test, or ex post facto once you have all of this. In the one case, ex post facto, you really do have the social practice. In the other case, where you merely claim you have it, you have the social practice in the paradigm case that underlies your reference to this. Okay, now this.
Concept.
Oh, it doesn't.
Now you can judge whether or not he acquired that concept, but clearly he's got the capacity to teach it to you in the future. He already has that concept, and you haven't demonstrated how he acquired it.
Well, that's why I'm talking about ex post facto. If he does indeed go through all of the right motions, you do wind up with a social practice, and now consider this sequence as itself a social practice of announcing, naming, describing and teaching.
He had the concept before he engaged in that social practice.
Did he? I just pointed out that without this apparatus, saying that he had the concept is on very shaky ground. Because if the rest didn't go with it, he didn't have the concept.
But to acquire that concept, he didn't have to name it or describe it or teach it to anybody. He simply had to come up with it.
As it turns out. Again, think of the ex post facto, that after the fact you can say he already had it back here, but before the fact you can't say it.
And so, like, say it or not, still, how does he acquire it?
Well, look, if the difference between eventually being able to say that he has the concept and not is that he participates in this practice of announcing an invention and describing it and teaching it, that is the social practice participation in which gets him that concept.
Yeah, but that's not relevant right now. That's not relevant to the issue, the naming, describing, etc. What is relevant is, how did he acquire that? How did he acquire it?
Well, methodologically, this is the answer.
That tells how he gives it to someone else.
Look, the point of the ex post facto argument is he hasn't got it. Unless he can give it to somebody else.
According to the person describing the situation, you're not talking about something in his head.
No, I'm not.
Heaven forbid. So, according to a person describing the situation, he can't say whether the person has the concept or not, so that in terms of his perception of the situation, that's how the person acquires it in relation to him, by presenting those things.
Nobody acquires a concept by simply inventing it, naming, describing it, and teaching it.
No, what I'm saying, acquires it in their head, you mean? Or acquires it according to the person that's interacting with them? I think that
Newton didn't develop.
Am I on the right track?
Yeah, you're on the right track.
Okay. I just, you have to touch base.
It seems to me that Newton didn't develop a calculus by inventing it, describing it, and teaching it to someone.
According to his students, the only way they could be sure he had it was the fact that he talked to them. So right. In turn, for them, that was how he acquired the concept.
Yeah. Now, how about for Newton? Suppose Newton had been in the position of never being able to tell anybody, never being able to teach it, and never having anybody understand it. Would he still insist that nevertheless he had that concept?
No.
Well?
Well, for Newton.
Now look, one of the things that's involved is rethinking this notion of acquiring. Because I think that if you don't do some reflecting, you're liable to take acquiring along the lines of where did it come from.
Yeah,
that's why I said quote acquired.
And think of acquiring not in terms of a process of acquisition, but in terms of a set of facts. The relevant facts consist of the transition from a time where he didn't have the concept to a time where he did. And then ask yourself, what does that transition consist of? And one answer is, here is a paradigm formulation of what that transition consists of. When this is the case, then one can say, in a straightforward way, he has that concept. Why? Because there is a place for that concept in this form of behavior. Now, anything short of this, you're going to need a paradigm case formulation to make sense of. And so the answer is, yeah, in the paradigm case, if he only has this, he needs a paradigm case which involves a social practice. In the paradigm case itself, he has the social practice. In both cases, a social practice, participation in it, and a practice in which there's a place for that concept is essential to it ever being the case eventually that, yes, he now has that concept. But as I say, this is not responsive to the question, by what process does he acquire? So when it comes to acquisition, don't think process, think of change in state of affairs.
I guess the way Maxim's worded, and thinking just normal examples, the acquiring takes on that connotation of how, what process he goes to become the acquisition.
Well, I hope not. Remember, the initial statement is we're working with facts and not processes and not things, primarily. And here's a good case in point. Now, I will say that it probably would be better, in fact, very likely we'll do change the wording, because this maxim is not the crucial one for acquisition. This is intended to deal with learning. And you're quite right in recognizing that when one invents something, that's different from learning. So that's why I say this is the tricky way of answering the question, and it isn't the best answer.
Even though you still make an argument that even when someone invents a new concept, then acquired that concept by actual experience.
Well, you
not
can
only with the concept, but with
other concepts. Mm. Yeah, but I want to keep the stronger formulation about the practice and experience, that the practice is one that involves the concept. And in the case that you might normally call generalizing from other experience, it would be practices that didn't involve the concept. So I'd rather give that up, because the much simpler answer is in Maxim 8. Not in Maxim 7. I say Maxim 7 was designed to deal with learning. Maxim 8 was designed to take account of the fact that there are other ways of acquiring ID concepts than by learning. And if you contrast invention to learning, then it's going to be Maxim 8 that'll take that one into account. And I think that in the interest of separating them, I might very well change the wording of Maxim 7 to say a person learns concepts and skills by practice and experience. The other thing to point out with that concept is that it doesn't say that you don't acquire concepts in any other way. It says that under these conditions you acquire concepts, not that there are no other conditions under which you do, and that leaves room for maxim 8. So let's move to maxim 8, which is even more stripped down. It simply says if you have a given person characteristic, you got it in one of the ways it can be gotten. And that leaves all the room you want for different ways that we might discover that people acquire characteristics. So what I had in mind there was something like surgical operations or taking a pill or something else of that sort. But certainly the notion of inventing one would fit that too. Now, one reason it's as open-ended is that you're now dealing with historical sorts of facts, namely, what kind of history did this individual have that resulted in his now having a certain ID characteristic? And historical facts are empirical. And so the question of which kinds of histories a person has to have to have a given person characteristic are also empirical. And all we can do then is have a formula that allows for any kind of relevant empirical findings to be plugged in. And any given observer will have some knowledge of some ways that some ID characteristics are acquired. And his use of the maxim then will be limited by how much of that sort he knows. And since they're empirical, you may also find that you thought you knew and you didn't. That certain ways that you thought were ways of acquiring certain characteristics aren't, or they have exceptions. Or ways that you didn't think were ways of acquiring a characteristic turn out that they aren't. Well, just think, I guess, mainly of abilities. How do you teach somebody to swim, to play chess, to do arithmetic, etc.? There are some known ways. You can try them with some people and find out that they're not. They don't learn. So for them, that wasn't. And that's a hazard that we all recognize, and there is a good place for a lot of further empirical research. It stems from the fact that historical facts are empirical. Now, maxim 8, because it's open-ended, as open-ended as it is, lends itself to some further elaboration. And the elaboration is what I've called the developmental schema, which appears in your outline. Now, since the developmental schema does double duty, there is part of it, namely this part, which is labeled Unit 1, that is not an elaboration of Maxim 8. It's this part here that's labeled Unit 2 that is the elaboration of Maxim 8. But since they go together, let's go through the schema as it is presented. Now, what this Unit 1 shows is the ingredients for accounting for behavior that occurs. Now, what we have is a three-way logical set. And as it works out, it is very nearly the case that if you know any two, you figure out the third. And specifically, if you know these two, you figure out either literally figure this one out, or you figure out constraints. So in general, as psychologists, we explain the occurrence of a given behavior by saying, well, in these circumstances, given that it was that kind of person, that's the behavior that you would find. Or if you know the kind of person and the circumstances, you can predict what kind of behavior he will engage in. Or you look at the behavior and the circumstances and say, well, it would take X kind of person to behave that way in those circumstances. Now, those are the kinds of things that typically psychologists do with this when it comes to explaining behavior. they look at these two things in order to explain the behavior. Now, this notion here of the personal characteristics is the part that you carry over when you give an ID description. And the reason you carry it over is because you can use it on other occasions at other times and places. And that's why when you're doing psychological assessments, you have special circumstances and special descriptions of behavior that are designed to facilitate your thinking about what kind of person it would take to engage in that behavior in these circumstances. We usually call it a test or a technique. The same relation will hold if you're simply watching somebody and you have some knowledge of circumstances, you see what they do, you can make judgments about the kind of people. Now, if you start explaining behavior and use these two notions to explain it, you then set up the conditions for a new question, namely, how come he's this kind of person? Now, the answer to that is given by another three-way formula, which connects the person's characteristics at an earlier time, the intervening history, and his characteristics at a later time. His being this way now is explained by his being this way before and having had this history in the meantime. Now, it's in this formula that we talk about capacity. If a person has a given characteristic now, it's because he had a prior capacity and the right kind of intervening history. Oh, it's this three-way relationship that is the elaboration of Maxim 8, which says that if a person has a given person characteristic, he got it in one of the ways that it can be gotten, namely by some combination of prior capacity and intervening history. Notice that it's a combination, because if you had different person characteristics here, it would in general take a different history to get you the same one over here. It's because you have that leeway that you encounter in Maxim 8, the phrase, in one of the ways it can be acquired. Now, two things. One, you can introduce any kind of taxonomy you want for what constitutes the capacity. You can introduce habit strength, you can introduce cognitive structures, you can introduce neurological processes. Anything you want may serve the purpose of categorizing the kind of capacity which you can empirically connect to a new ID description later on. And all of the ones that I've mentioned, at least those, have been used by psychologists for this purpose. In addition, you can just talk about capacities. You can also just talk about personal characteristics and which of them connect to which of them via which histories. So you don't have to go to any special taxonomy. You can just stay with the kind of taxonomy that's provided by the list of a person's person characteristics. And indeed, any taxonomy that you include here will simply be adding to the set of personal characteristics that you're dealing with. For example, if I introduce certain cognitive structures, the having of that cognitive structure is simply another ID notion.
Could you say any new information there? It seems like another way of naming.
No, I'm saying that formally it will simply be another ID characteristic. See, there's no formal limit to the set of ID characteristics that you can plug in. So you can invent one simply by introducing some kind of concept here. Right. Remember, this is an elaboration of the maxim. It's intended to get at the logic of the explanation, to get at why some reference to a cognitive structure here and a reference to a cognitive structure there can have any kind of explanatory value. The reason it does is it fits the formula that says prior capacity plus intervening history gives you ID characteristic. And any plugging in of a ID characteristic here and some kind of characterization of a history will give you that kind of logic of explanation. And it'll give you that whether the explanation is true or false. Maybe a bad explanation or a false one, but it will be an explanation. Now, that is not something that is brought out if all you have are references to cognitive structures and some kind of history. You might then wonder how come this explains this. So in terms of the maxim, you see, when it comes to thinking of maxims not as informatives, but as rules of proceeding, if you put it explicitly in terms of rules of proceeding, it comes out, if you want to explain a person characteristic, you refer to some relevant prior characteristic and some kind of intervening history.
In the case of maturation, is your intervening history just pretty much fine?
No. I think there was one thing I forgot to mention with abilities that's also relevant here. Abilities are always relevant to circumstances. See, in giving examples of ability, I said, think of knowing how to do arithmetic. If I know how to do arithmetic, then give me an arithmetic problem, and if I'm trying, you can expect me to solve it. When one gives ability descriptions with no qualification, there is an understood qualification, namely under normal conditions. It's quite clear that I might know how to do arithmetic in the normal sense, but if you put me on a high wire over a fire, I probably couldn't solve many arithmetic problems. Or if somebody was sticking pins in me, I might do very poorly at solving arithmetic problems. But under normal conditions, yes. If I know how and I'm trying, you can expect me to succeed. So that there's an implicit qualification when one doesn't qualify. Now, it's not possible to specify what conditions are normal conditions. See, that's an open-ended clause. Now, here, you see, when it comes to maturation, you have the same kind of open-ended clause, namely, under normal conditions, given certain development here, 2 years later you'll see this, and you're not specifying the kind of history except by saying under normal conditions or by implying it. And this will come out clearly because you can imagine conditions in those intervening 2 years where you wouldn't get that so-called maturational development. And if you need a clear-cut case, just imagine a history in which the person dies. But it isn't time per se. If a person dies 2 years later, he's not going to have it. It's some open-ended reference to under normal conditions. And whereas that may not be satisfying if you're looking for detailed description, it certainly is workable in many circumstances. Certainly is of some practical value to be told that under normal circumstances, by age 3, a child can do such and such. And to make use of that, you don't have to have a description of what normal circumstances are. So you have that kind of non-committal specification here. Here, capacity is simply the potential for acquiring person characteristics. And there's no limit to which person characteristics. It may be ability, it may not. Now, know-how is a learning history that makes certain performances not a matter of chance. But there's no generality here. It's the notion of ability that has generality. I said, if I have the ability to do arithmetic, then there's all kinds of specific arithmetic tasks that I could be expected to succeed at. And it's the ability over here that is accounted for by my prior capacity and history. I was already back here somebody who had the capacity to acquire the ability to do arithmetic. Yeah, because of this connection, that what gives me the capacity may be some more particular person characteristic, including a know-how or a cognitive structure or something. But in this position here, capacity simply is a potential. And that's why we use a different term. The person characteristics are actual. The person has those characteristics. Here, what he has is the potential for becoming this way. And so even though it's the characteristics he have that give him the potential, we separate the notion of potential from the notion of the characteristics he has. And that's why in your diagram, there's these three notions that are, the comment is, these are different versions of the same thing. Now, we haven't gotten to this third one yet, and we won't for a while. Okay, to backtrack, I said there's two comments. One is that you could introduce any kind of taxonomy you wanted here. The second is that there's no metric associated with this. There's nothing that specifies the size of the interval. And the interval could be anything you want, then, since it's not specified. It means that you can do this over and over again. You can start here, go back to a prior capacity, which depends on the personal characteristics. From here, go back to a still prior set of characteristics via the history. From here, go back to a still prior set until you get to some kind of limiting point here, which you may date as birth, conception, or whatever. But you will reach a point of that sort. So this formula 2 here is a repeatable one. You can calculate this back by the second, minute, hour, day, year, etc. There's no limit to how often you do it. The practical limits are the period of time over which you can detect some change in characteristics. But the logic is the same no matter how many times you do it, no matter what size of the unit temporally, no matter what kind of taxonomy you use. It's still the same kind of explanation. Now, the way the formula works, you go from something you have to something else that you have later. And that creates a peculiar problem down here. Because here, you don't have anything. And the problem of getting from something to something else is different from the problem of getting from nothing to something. See, if you have person characteristics, it's easy to see how by using them in your behavior, you can acquire other and further characteristics. It's not easy to see how, if you have no person characteristics, you can acquire some of them. So you might say the logic of this type of explanation leads you to some problem of how do you begin.
Maybe you should open.
Well, there are two classic ways of evading the problem by denying that it exists. And the one is to go to biology and genetics and say, no, even down here, there is already something and he has those kinds of person characteristics. The other is to go to reincarnation or something of that sort and say, no, his life extends back indefinitely. He already has person characteristics. Now, the problem with going to with either of these solutions is that they constrain your possibilities. Here, you're into a different sort of enterprise altogether if you have to talk about reincarnation. And you are usually violating Maxim 1. That at birth, a child doesn't seem to have any such carryover of ID characteristics. And on the other hand, if you go to biology, then you're doing biology, not psychology, and you have a hard time ever getting the psychology back into the picture.
I don't see why biology.
It doesn't seem to be the case, and yet this is a statement, and nevertheless, it is the case.
Well, it depends on who's doing
it. Well, there's very few people who claim to remember back when, or to have other evidence that they lived before their birth. And the case for saying that, even though it doesn't seem to be that way, it is not satisfying to most people. So the basic thing is that you violate Maxim 1, and then that calls for an explanation. And if a good explanation is forthcoming, okay. But the explanations that have been forthcoming have not been okay with most people that I know.
I'm not sure why you violate the distinction between an original biological capacity and psychological. It doesn't seem like you have to make a distinction. You can say that
no, if you're talking about behavior, it's got to be a behavioral capacity. Remember what I said about pathology, that just the bare fact of physiological anomaly doesn't make an illness. There has to be a restriction on ability to engage in behavior. The same thing will hold here. No matter what you look like physiologically, it's got to be the behavioral capacity that's involved. But then, and that's why I say that when you go overtly to physiology, you have a hard time ever doing anything other than studying physiology. You have a hard time getting behavior back into the picture. In fact, yeah. You have to do things like Freud or something like that. Now, you could, with some sleight of hand, convert any relevant physiology into a behavioral capacity by fiat, by simply saying, when I use this term, I am now using it not as a physiological term, but as a taxonomy for some behavioral capacity. But remember, that was fishy over here. I said, it may be that having this characteristic gives you this capacity, but the characteristic isn't the same as the capacity. So you have that awkwardness over here. It may be that having a certain structure gives you this capacity, but having that structure is not the same as having that capacity. And the issue is, can you convert that structure into a person characteristic? And I said, you can by fiat, by simply converting it from biological terminology into behavioral terminology with the same observational and other basis. Still, if you don't want to do that, and you might not want to for the sake of keeping it behavioral, then we can ask this kind of question. what's the minimum that you have to put in here in order to, for the whole series to go? What's the least that one could start with behaviorally that would enable a person to acquire person characteristics? And for this, we have another notion, the notion of capable of. Now, the definition of being capable of doing X it's a weaker form of competence than either ability or know-how. They said, if I have the ability to do something, then there are a wide range of circumstances under which I could be expected to succeed. If I'm capable of doing something, all that implies is there's at least one set of circumstances in which I could be expected to succeed. And so it's a much weaker condition than having the ability. Now, this is the condition, the weakest condition that will enable us to work this thing forward. Because if I'm capable of doing X, then there is at least one circumstance in which I could be expected to succeed. And if that circumstance occurs, then the expectation is that I will succeed in doing that. And by doing that, I will start acquiring person characteristics of the usual sort.
Isn't that original capable of the person characteristics?
Which?
The original capability.
Yeah. That's all that has to be there originally. Yeah. The only thing that has to be there originally is capability.
Wouldn't that be a person characteristic?
Yeah. But it's a peculiar one. That's why See, it's not like the usual ones. And that's why, even though I listed it under ID characteristics, I said, let's wait to develop it until later. And here you see why it's of particular importance.
It's some kind of a capability notion. You have to wait for a later characteristic to develop before you can
move that one. See, this whole thing is reconstructive. You do not start from here, you start from here. And it's because you already know that a person has a given characteristic that you know that he must have had the potential back here. And it's because here he acquires some characteristics that you know he must have had the potential back there.